Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome along to the penultimate, we think, Full Throttle podcast from Eurosport in 2021. It's Monday, the 15th of November. Well, this is it. Greg Haynes with you. And this weekend, this is the finale. I can't quite believe it. We've had 4 weekends off since Argentina. But this weekend in Indonesia, the brand new Mandalika track on the island of Lombok, we are going to find out who will be crowned World Superbike Champion of 2021. Will it be Toprak Razgatlioglu on the Yamaha, the first Yamaha champion since Ben Spies in 2009? Or will it be an incredible comeback for Jonathan Rea to make it what would be 7 titles in a row since 2015. We'll be live in the early hours of Saturday and Sunday mornings. All the information and the times coming up later in the show. But let's crack on, because I've had a great season of commentary with either James Whittam or James Toseland. James Whittam, of course, with us for the whole season here on Eurosport. JT stepped in on the clash rounds when Whit was otherwise engaged at BSB. And I really couldn't decide which of the two to join us for this last preview podcast of the season. So what did we do? We organised a Skype call last week. I got both of them on. And as you can imagine, there was a good amount of banter and quite a lot of tension in the air as we get ready for this weekend. Well, I didn't really know which one of you to pick for this, because we've had some great laughs in the commentary box, haven't we? Taking the mickey and having some informative and entertaining chats on and off air all season long. So I thought I better get both of them together. So it's James Whittam, we'll refer to him as Whit, and James Toseland, who we'll refer to as JT to make it a little bit less confusing. Whit, we'll start with you. How are you? How's the last few weeks been? It's been a long wait for this last race, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit odd, really, that there's such a 5-week gap. Especially when we're all on tenterhooks as to what is actually going to happen. It's been the best end the best boiling up to an end of a championship in World Super that we've seen for a long, long time. So yeah, I hope it hasn't lost any. I don't think it will have. Certainly, I'm excited about seeing what's going to happen. But we have been sort of hanging on it for 5 weeks, haven't we?
JT, you definitely picked the right season to return to broadcasting, didn't you?
Do you know, I'm genuinely getting a bit nervous, because it was a little bit annoying that this 5-week gap that it's been between the penultimate one and the last one. And it was like, because the momentum's been rolling so fast on it all year. Like, is it Toprak? Is it Johnny? Da, 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 da. And, you know, even Scott was there or thereabouts, you know, only a couple of races ago. So it was like a 3-horse race at one, you know, not long ago. So it was like, I was just desperate, like, because we're all impatient, aren't we, at races? I was just impatient to get a conclusion to it. But now it's kind of, it's only this week. It's like, it does, I kind of forgot the last 3 or 4 weeks. And like, I'm now in the race week mode.
Race mode.
And I'm generally getting a bit nervous for it, because, you know what it's like, the week before you've got a chance of becoming a world champion. Like, I'm sure Johnny's not as nervous, being, you know, seeing as he's got 6 already on his mantelpiece. but for Toprak, this is the biggest week of his life.
In a way, I think it's quite apt that we say it a lot, that one thing that Kawasaki's got is they've got the data, they've got the history, they've been every circuit before. And one thing we've got here with the new circuit is the fact that nobody's got anything. Like you said, brand new asphalt that nobody knows how it's going to perform, how it's going to feel, if it's going to suit a Kawasaki. The track to me looks, in planned form, it looks a little bit of everything, some slow corners, but some real fast ballsy stuff as well. So it's almost perfect that nobody's got an experience, nobody's got any data. Both teams, which is we're talking about two teams in actual fact for that championship, and I think it's going to be cracking. We're not, because you just don't know what's going to happen. You can't put our money on either.
You can't. And I think the most important session of the whole season will be FP1. If in FP1, Phil, Top Rack's chief engineer, has done as much homework as he can back in the workshop, which he will have done. If Top Rack goes out and the gearing's all right, the balance is all right, suspension's all right, and Top Rack is in the top three, then it'll be a normal 30-point lead of a championship, and he should win.
Correct.
Mm. If they get a bit unlucky, and all of a sudden John is a second faster in FP1 than the Yam, because of all those factors.
Yeah.
That's 30 points going to slip away rapid.
Yeah.
Correct.
So,
you said they're going to do the homework that they can. Phil Marin at Yamaha, Top Rack man, he knows how to do his homework. I know when we went to Most, nobody'd ridden at Most, virtually nobody of the regular front runners at any day to the teams didn't. And the lengths that Yamaha went to get Top Rack as much information, they went to all the Yamaha.
They got it from Yacht, didn't they?
They got it from
Yacht boys.
Yeah, they got it from the German teams that have ridden there, and they got everything. So they went in with as much information as they could, and that definitely played dividends. I don't know that they're going to be able to do this with this circuit, because I think they're virtually just finishing it off, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they've got a race weekend this weekend for the junior or the Asian Cup.
Yes, they have.
Just to give it a bit of a run out, you know, and I think that's not just the track. I think that's obviously the Marshall points, the TV points for the camera positions, the garages, the electric in the garage, you know.
Yeah.
All of the production that you can think of, that it's not just bikes going down a track. There's so much production behind the scenes that needs to work as well. So fingers crossed it'll all go well this weekend, because if there's something fundamentally wrong with the track this weekend for the Asia Cup, we could get a cancellation.
You know what, that's a fair point, that JT, because you can put everything in place. People know how a circuit works and what you need and safety kind of regulations and all that. However, until until you get something done, you really, something could crop up that you've never even thought.
Yeah.
You know, you get people going around and the riders flag up some kind of issue that isn't going to be able to be sorted in a week. You know, it's a close call.
Yeah, like the Navarra situation where we had that crash, and then we realised on commentary they hadn't got a service road down the edge.
No.
So when we had a serious accident and it was on the floor, and it was you got to question whether we needed emergency vehicles to go and give him service. They had to stop the race and shut the racing down on the thing. So it's obviously it's world championship racing. The safety officers and the technical directors and all the rest of the team, they are the best in the business, and I'm sure they've been out there and done all their due diligence on it. So fingers crossed it'll all work out well.
Portimao, when Portimao was first built, I went to commentate with Jack and for the first World Superbike round there, and literally that was the first time anybody, apart from local riders, did that testing the place to see how it went, just, you know. That was the first meeting. First top line riders were there. And literally, there was no road to the circuit because they hadn't got time to put the road in. So you're on a goat track to get to it. And then this massive, brand new, multi-million pound facility hoved into view when you're on your goat track in your hire car. When you got there, it still smelled of paint. The guy had just finished with his roller, finishing the press room off of paint. So it does work, and it did work that weekend there. So with a bit of luck, like you said, we'll be all right.
Let's put ourselves in Top Rack's mind here, because I'm thinking, you know, if all goes according to plan, like you said before, JT, it should be relatively straightforward, shouldn't it? If he wins race one and Jonathan Rea is third or lower, Top Rack is world champion. However, let's just say something goes wrong for the Yamaha, and it has happened before this year, and Jonathan wins race one, it's down to 5 points with two races still to go on the Sunday.
Yeah.
So JT, starting with you on this one, you've been in this position before where you're vying for a world championship. How does Toprak go in, bearing in mind they've got 2 days of hotel quarantine as well when they get there, to really think about the whole situation? How is he not going to overthink this? Because he doesn't make mistakes. He copes well under pressure, but he's never been in this situation before.
Well, FP1's the, if you're a card player, if you're a poker player, FP1 is the deal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And when Toprak turns those two cards over halfway through FP1, he'll see if he's got an ace and a king or a two and a four. You know, if that Yamaha works out the garage straight away and it's comfortable with his riding ability and his confidence at the minute on that bike with the team he's racing for, there is no way that Toprak is going to be easy to beat, right? And if you're not easy to beat, then he should be in the top three or four and he should take the championship with a 30-point lead. That is how it is going to roll out, right? If he is a second slow on Friday morning than Jonathan Rea, that lead is no more. You've just got to scratch out what you can, where you can, and try and just grab onto every single point that you've got as an advantage to do that. But that's what you'll be thinking, right? Yeah. In the hotel, that's how I'd be thinking. I'd be thinking, please, let me put my helmet on Friday morning in that garage, cock my leg over that bike, and whatever I do on that track, how I do it, because you're not going to know, right? You can run around it, you can cycle around it, you might be able to take your scooter around, whatever, but you are not going to know how Toprak on a Yamaha on that track is going to perform, and he'll just be fingers crossed looking at his pit board and keep coming in the garage looking at his name, hopefully in and around Jonathan. But if I tell you what, if Jonathan's there with the second advantage on Friday afternoon, it's going to be really interesting.
Wait, what about Indonesia as well with the temperatures? I mean, you won in Indonesia, didn't you, at Sentul in 94?
Yeah.
You know, is that going to be challenging? There's going to be rain every day, they're predicting. It's the monsoon season. I mean,
it is.
Just imagine it's what could happen.
Be having a race in Indonesia, because like you say, the monsoon could well have broken. It's going to be hot and humid and awful and potentially pouring down with rain. However, I honestly think that the way that Toprak is and the way the season's gone, remember, he's made no mistakes, none this year. The DNFs have been a breakdown and he got swiped.
And so his mudguard.
He will be really, and he's going to be, I'm not going to say overconfident or confident, he's going to know that he's got that 30-point lead. And as long as nothing goes really badly wrong, I think that he's going to be in the hunt. Remember, it's not just him and Jonathan that have been to this place. None of the other people that Jonathan needs to get in between those two, if he's got any chance of the championship, they both stay on and both the bikes keep going. We've got to assume that. Everybody else is brand new to the place. They might struggle. I think he's going to be reasonably confident, unless he gets some really bad luck, that he's... got one under it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely, he definitely has. I'm just thinking, though, if it is rainy season, you know what it's like with him. It's like, if you want to be within a second of someone, please let it just be dry all weekend. Let's just have it nice and consistent, right? Because if you know when I'm talking about rolling the bike out and hope everything just works okay, and you're all right, right? Well, the chances of it not being all right in the rain are twice as...
At least twice. The chances of having a silly mistake, touching a white line.
At least twice. Yeah, the bum will be definitely twitching if the forecast is wet.
I was looking into this as well with this monsoon season. There's two monsoon seasons in Indonesia. One of them is now, for the first ever World Superbike round. The other one is in March, which is exactly when the first MotoGP race is happening there. So they've not really timed that very well. But it's great, isn't it, to be able to go to a new venue for the last round. It's a bit like what happened last year with Estoril. That was new for World Superbikes with the current field. But this, like we said before, there's no video footage apart from this Asia Talent Cup race that will have happened by the time this podcast goes out. You know, it's amazing, isn't it, that we've got no onboard laps. There's no footage they can look at. It's completely new.
It's the most level playing field for a championship decider that I have ever seen. Honestly, we went to a championship decider in 93. It was Scott with a slightly longer take.
We got
to a place called, I don't know what the circuit was called, but it was in a Sportland, Mexico City. It was in, there were football pitches in the middle of the circuit.
Yeah.
Balls back across it. There were stray dogs wandering across. The circuit security was the issue, and we didn't end up racing. But that would have been another absolutely level playing field towards the end of the
season. Oh, yeah, the race was cancelled, wasn't it? I remember.
Yeah, that's the only thing we don't want happening, isn't it? Some sort of unforeseen problem like that. What a tragedy that would be.
Well, saying that, though, sat here right now, if this last race was cancelled, the right man wins the championship for me. That's the nice thing.
I believe.
You know, like Whittam said, he hasn't made a mistake. He's had three non-scorers without his being his mistake. I think Jonathan Reyes rode amazingly well with that underpowered and lack of handling on the front on the tight corners on Kawasaki this year. So absolutely fair play to taking it to the last race, because I don't think that Kawasaki should have taken it to the last race. It's because of Jonathan.
Yeah.
But if it is cancelled now and Toprak is declared the world superbike champion, for me, no, I ain't got a problem with that.
You know what you just said there? You touched on it. I think you're absolutely spot on. I have never seen a man override a bike that didn't deserve to be quite where it was being put by the rider for as long, for as many laps and as many races as Jonathan's managed to do this year. And what's really impressed me, the man's got 6 championships. I don't know. I've never been to his house, but it's a nice big posh house. And he's got everything he wants and a few quid at bank. And he is still prepared, quite prepared, to do amazing things and push the limits and step over that limit to take it to Toprak. That's amazed me how much he's prepared to roll his sleeves up and have a fist fight. He's been brilliant.
Well, I saw a completely different side to him with the Magny-Cours shenanigans, right? When I saw him whisper over Pereira and do that and have those tactics with that kind of vigour and that kind of... That sneaky, non-relenting, like competitiveness that he'll ride over your gran, right?
Yeah.
To get the better of you. I've not seen that in Jonathan, because we've not seen that in Jonathan because no one's taken him to the wire before, like Toprak has. So this is why we're seeing every single different personality trait of Jonathan Rea this year, because his back's against the wall. And I tell you what, to do what he's done, to win 6 championships and still do what you're saying, Whit, it's because he is that competitive. And when you're that competitive, you're not that likable, are you? You
know? Yeah. You've got to have your own views on what happened at Magny-Cours.
But being that competitive is not a likable trait. I mean, once you take your helmet off, you can be calmed down. But
I think the point you're making is that he doesn't care if he's liked or not. It don't matter. Sometimes he's going to be. But he doesn't care if he isn't to get the job done.
This year especially, I think, innit? Because of the situation Toprak put him in. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, we've all had an opinion on that Magny-Cours thing, haven't we? But at the end of the day, I think we've all been like really blown away about how competitive Jonathan Rea really is.
Mm.
It's been staggering, hasn't it?
If the man is going down, he's going down swinging.
He certainly is.
He's not. You know,
forget my opinion on either side, if you agree with me or not, right?
Exactly.
That's not the point. The point is, I tell you what, we've been lucky to enjoy some of the best superbike races and racing that I've witnessed for many, many years. We've had great battles in superbikes all the time, to be honest, whether it's someone that you're a fan of or not, or you say, you know, with the popularity levels or what, we've always had generally pretty good superbike racing at the front.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've got to thank Scott Smart for that as well. Do you not think, with the way the regulations, I think we said it's 8 different teams have been on the podium this season, 8 different teams.
Yeah, and it's not an easy job to keep different configurations. And remember, it was different CCs when the twins were back. To keep it balanced over different natured tracks, where sometimes you might have an advantage with a little bit more torque, some need a bit more top end, and they've kept it reasonably well balanced. I think that one of the problems they've had over the last few years is Jonathan has been so good on the Kawasaki that how can you allow these extra 500 revs that Kawasaki thought they were going to get because they increased the revs on the road bike? How can you give somebody who's already at the front? most weekends. You know, it's difficult to justify that. So I think they've done a really good job. It seems unfair at times, but I think in terms of close racing, they've done a fantastic job. And that is not easy to keep it that sort of level.
Guys, just also while we're talking about Scott Smart there, we're going to have to talk about Paul Smart. That terrible news we heard, the loss of Paul Smart the other day. I mean, what a name, you know, famous, of course, most of all for winning the Imola 200, but a big, big shock and all our thoughts with the Smart family at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I know him really well as a good friend. I just about remember him racing as I was a real young kid. But more than all that, he was just a lovely, lovely gentleman, a real gentleman. You know, him and Maggie always used to come and watch at Brands Hatch, and they were just lovely people. And it's sad. It's a sad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Every time I had the pleasure of meeting him, he always stopped and talked to you and wanted to talk with you without distraction. That's how I remember. And he always had his complete focus and concentration when he came up for a chat with you. And in an environment in a paddock,
difficult.
It is difficult that,
yeah.
And that just showed you know the makeup of the man really. And yeah. I always enjoyed every chat with him. It's been a tough year for losses from the youngsters, haven't we? Three teenagers and then to Paul. It's certainly had its downs as well as ups, that's for sure.
Yeah, actually, on that note, JT, starting with you, we have had some modified age limits, haven't we? And the reduction of the size of the field in Supersport 300. I remember Witt and I were talking about this in podcasts weeks, months ago. It's been going on all year. JT, starting with you on this one, though, what do you make of these age limits? Minimum 18 in all the MotoGP categories now. Some increases to all the other junior categories too. Is that a step in the right direction?
I think it is. I think now what we've realised is teaching these kids at 5, 6, 7 years old how to go around on a motorcycle on the tarmac, not just bobble around on a trials bike or a motocross bike on a field. They are learning the discipline of road racing, which generally is a lot faster because of the grip levels on the asphalt, and we're not taking into consideration the maturity of these kids, and we can't expect them to have a certain amount of maturity with the speed and the competitiveness and the lack of their lack of inhibition and self-preservation. That's what it is, because that's why being youthful is great. There was a saying that these kids don't know what they can't do yet, right? And that's what you need, and that's why races go racing. But we need to protect that, we need to harness that, and we need to make sure that we unleash that at the right time. And I think for me it's been a good decision.
Yeah, Whit, what's your take on it? Because as I said before, we've talked about this all year long, haven't we? Supersport 300 that we've been commentating on and Moto3, those two categories, they've been super, super entertaining. They always have been, but a little bit scary this year.
Yeah, I've got my own feelings on that, and it's quite simple for me. I would hate to think that people would look at me and think that I was against motorcycle racing or any dangerous sport. I'm not. You ought to have the right, as long as it doesn't affect anybody else, to do what you want, in my opinion. If that's strap a wingsuit onto yourself and jump out of an aeroplane, so be it. Parachuting, rock climbing, horse riding, fishing, speedboating, whatever you want, do it, if it doesn't affect anybody else's safety. However, you need to be of an age where you have the ability and mental maturity to take decisions on which your life may depend. And if you are 14 on a bike that has the capacity, on a track that has the capacity to kill you, you're not old enough. You're not old enough. You, at 14 or 13, even worse, you require your parents not only to earn money to buy you food, clothes, schooling, you need them to look after you and take some decisions for you. And for me, there has to be an age limit where... And what I mean by don't stop them going on tarmac. keep them on kart tracks where they're doing 50 miles an hour, where the damage can be done is limited. To go on full-size circuits, and I mean Cadwell or Monza or any of them, right? Any circuit, any GP-style world championship circuit or national championship circuit that's got tarmac and putting kids on bikes that have the capacity and speed to kill them is not a good idea for me. And actually, the FAM should be the watchdog on this. Not Dorna. The FAM are the... This is the Federation of Motorcyclists worldwide, like the ACU is for the UK. They should say, hang on a minute, what do you want to do? Oh, well, we want to put 13-year-old kids on motorbikes around big circuits and put pressure on them and make them win a championship and offer them prizes for doing that, have a ride in another class the year after. The FAM should have gone, no, that's a really bad idea. But no, they've gone along with everything, and now they're having to reverse out of the cul-de-sac that they built. And you know, I don't want to be too scathing, but yes, it's a move in the right direction. Yes, it's a good decision. Shouldn't have had to be made because it should have been never there in the first place. It's not a good thing. And for what reason? Why were we doing it? Why were we doing it? We were doing it to make a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old world champ. Well, hey, well, let's make 22-year-old world champs who want to do it. You know, I never got it. I don't get it. And I think it's a step in the right direction, yes.
Yeah, because without getting too macabre on this, I also think of the mental effect it has for some of those other kids that were involved in the Dean Berta Vinales accident, for example, and what they had to witness there. Yes. JT, you were going to add something there.
I can't agree more. I think everybody's on the same page here. I was just thinking about the monetary side of it as well, because you look at Wayne Gardner. I know had the financial strain, and now McKenzie, I know the financial strain it's taken to get his two lads up to top at British Superbike level, and obviously Remy's got a chance of winning the Moto2, and it's cost hundreds of thousands to get Remy an opportunity to put himself in the shop window. Obviously getting a 17-year-old world champion for manufacturers and for the show, because the show needs showmen. And yeah. if you're a star at 17, they've got the longevity there for having a star like Rossi, 25 years in the game and building the popularity, because motorcycle racing, as much as it is about the technical side with the motorcycles and selling motorbikes to actually put the show on, it's about stars. And but we were getting earlier and earlier to have the longevity of that, and we're getting too early for it.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And not only that, if you squeezing these kids through a system, and this is what it is, it's a tiered system that only has one goal in the end, and that is not to have a Moto3 world champ. We've had a Moto3 world champ from this country, Danny Kent. And guess what? He was seen as an abject failure because he couldn't make the step up to another class and win a world championship in the next class up. They're pointing everybody towards the pinnacle of this sport, which is only one man, and that is the MotoGP world champ. So all these thousands of kids who start and are offered the world and have the parents getting skinned, 99.999% of them are going to be disappointed, because only one of them out of a whole generation can actually get to where the system is set up to get them to. It's a weird thing. Go back, James, if you can remember, when you were a kid, there used to be 250, good 250 riders. Might be before your time, but people like Tony Mang, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 times a world champ, right, mm-hmm. on 250 and 350. He was and he'd never wanted to race a 500. He wanted to be a 250, and he was a star for that. Angel Nieto, 13 times a world 80, 50, and 125 championship winner. A legend in his own country. Nowadays, with this system we've got, he'd be looked on as a complete failure because he couldn't win the MotoGP World Championship. And that's that's a bit sad, I think.
Yeah, but is that a global outlook thought, or is that because we're in the game? You know what I mean? How far does that spread wide, if you know what I mean? That is that a UK thing, you think, James? Or
no, I think it's more or less a Spanish thing this has come from.
Do you think that's changed since Dorna's been involved, maybe in the last 25, 30 years since 92, and they've bigged up MotoGP?
Well, I mean, it definitely has changed in that time, for the reason I'm not, you know, I wouldn't I won't want to try and put my finger on exactly who and what and why it's gone that way, but it definitely has gone that way. Mm. Everything is a feeder now, even Moto2. You never talk about, people forget Moto2 world champions. It's great when somebody wins it. Hey, he's won the Moto2 world champion. Ooh, oh, what rides you got in Moto Grand Prix? You've got to move on. It's almost like a game show.
Do you know what I think the problem is, though? Coming back to what I was kind of hinting, I kind of made 2 points, but then made one out of two. Mate. But I think it's a monetary issue as well, James, because in Moto3 and Moto2 now, you have to pay to even do it, right?
Correct.
And so the only paying professional ride is in the top 10, 12 of MotoGP, right? There is a few people bringing money to MotoGP even at the elite level. So I think that's definitely not helping this funnel effect pushing everybody towards that, because while you're having to put £200,000 in of your own money to even do the job, and this is national level as well. I mean, yeah. I've just been talking to a close friend of mine trying to find a ride, and he cannot get a ride cheaper than 150 grand in British Supersport.
Yep.
British Supersport. So there's no wonder that everybody's thinking that we need to be in that paddock, because that's the only way I'm going to earn a living after it. And if you've been on bikes from being 5-6 years old, and you've done all your training and you got pretty handy on a motorcycle, and you get to six in the UK. Imagine finishing six in any national UK championship, any of them, right? You're doing pretty well. It's all relative, yeah. Isn't it?
Mm.
If you finish six on a 125 or six on a superbike, you've ridden the same. It's just as hard to be that competitive at any of them. But it's at six, if you're 16 years old, and you're six in the British Championship, your family's probably put about £250,000 in.
Correct. And remortgaged their house in some cases.
Yeah, and it's getting worse. I mean, I think one of the problems for the industry was when tobacco got banned, because all of a sudden it was on a false economy. And you know, the energy drinks have caught, they've caught that. It's to some level, but nowhere near the same level. And, you know, that the elite, there's a few people earning decent money in Moto2 at the top, a few hundred thousand, but you know, there's multi-millions if you're MotoGP champion, but the drop-off is far too dramatic,
And it's not even the drop-off, it's the complete swing.
Yeah,
it's,
and that's
swing from earning
everybody
decent money, yeah, two rows behind them, they're paying all they've ever earned to be there.
Absolutely. And that needs to change, because that's not helping the push that you're talking about.
I agree.
Yeah, because even in Junior Moto3, Monlau Competition, Estrella Galicia, run by Emilio Alfamora, they're talking 400k, aren't they? €500,000 sometimes in the Moto3 Junior World Championship. Imagine we got a system in where there was an automatic promotion, but how would that happen? That would need all the organisers of all the national Superbike Championships, Prototype Championships, CIV, BSB and everyone. So I guess it would have to be led by the FIM, wouldn't it, to get together. I can't see how else they could make that work.
Well, the wages are paid by manufacturers at the minute. I'm not sure if that's a good idea.
Mm.
I don't know whether there should be some monetary control about a set system that you get paid for certain level. You know, it's like back in the old days, you used to get a little envelope with your prize money in if you were first, or if you were 15th, it went down to 15th back in the day. You got 50 quid or something if you were 10th. But there was a set pyramid system.
JT, Barry Sheen used to get a bit more than 50 quid, didn't he, in his brown envelope at Cadwell, if the stories are anything to go by.
You've got to be careful. That's a bit of a tricky road to be sort of navigating, because when you've got a sport that's as individual as all sports are individual, even team sports, people on different wages, different footballers, you know, your star men in the same team, and they get a lot more money than their teammates. And it's the same in bike racing. You've got to be careful that you don't have, if you've got a pay structure, well, then I went round, I did the same job as let's say in my day it would have been Foggy, because I went round a track on a motorbike and I opened the throttle and I crashed sometimes, but he earned a lot more money than me, so I want the same money as him. You've got to be careful there, because, you know, he's won 7 world championships and I didn't. So you're almost paid what you deserve. The market supports that. So I don't think
if it's results based, it'll go back to the same situation, I suppose.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. difficult. It is difficult. That's a difficult
big
one.
Discussion.
Yeah, but some. I think, but it's definitely not helping that.
It definitely
push, this push. No.
Just going back to the safety.
It's
sorry, JT. The safety aspect for a second. Obviously, we'll have to just underline again, and we've said this a lot over the year anyway, haven't we, on our output and on the podcast here, that those three accidents that claimed the lives of those teenagers, Jason DePasquier and Mugello in Moto3, Hugo Mian in a European Talent Cup race at Aragon, and then, of course, Dean Bertavignale's Supersport 300 in Jerez. They were incidents that could have happened on any track at any time in any category, weren't they, in the sense that somebody's crashed and being run over. However, go on, James, sorry.
It isn't, none of those crashes were a symptom of track safety. They were, for me, they were at least in part because they were all in low powered classes, therefore more people can get the best out of those bikes. They were in classes where you are limited in the setup you can do to that bike, so there's no difference to be gained there. And because of all that, you make it so that the racing is absolutely as close as it can be, which is brilliant if you're watching it. But what it does mean is, if you do fall down, there's generally you are in a pack and you therefore have a lot more chance of getting hit by a following rider. And that is the problem.
Well, on that note, actually, I was chatting the other day with Nico Sartori, who's a very successful crew chief. He's working at the moment with Anna Carrasco, but he's worked with Keenan Sofoglu, Jill Cluzel, Luca Myers. He's worked with Superbikes, Supersport Bikes, 300 Bikes. He's been around a long time. And I messaged him because I was doing a feature for MCN on the safety, and I wanted his opinion on the matter as he's working in Supersport 300. And he said he was actually very glad I contacted him because he feels the media can push this even more. And he said he and Joan Lascourts, who, of course, was paralysed in a very nasty accident himself, a very unlucky one at Imola. They went recently to Scott Smart, and one of the suggestions they've put forward to Scott, and he said this could be done at the moment with the ECU that the 300 bikes use, is to, when they're in a gaggle, make the ECU of the bike connect with the lights on the back of the bikes, because he said one problem they have been having is that they're not seeing yellow flags, they're not seeing red flags, or at least they're seeing them too late because they're focused on what's happening around them. And he said the lights could flash on the back of the bike to a certain intensity for yellow flags, another one for red flags. Another idea was to have a sort of flare inside activated by the same system, the same gas that activates the airbag. So when a rider crashes and he's in the middle of the circuit, a sort of smoke flare goes up in red smoke. I mean, that would make them more visible. It's good they're talking about stuff like this, isn't it, James? I mean, that sounds to me like a decent idea, Whit. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I read all that. The flashing lights, very bright LED type on your dashboard. Mm. Even though you're not looking at it, you would see it in peripheral vision.
Well, they said the dashboard, but they also said the lights on the back of the bike as well. It would all be connected
So, but having that, having some illuminated kind of warning. Yes, I get that.
Yeah,
I think the idea of the smoke bomb leathers, for me, don't hold much water, just because it'd be so complicated. If you did get a sort of, an accidental discharge, let's say.
Yeah.
That'd be, you know what I mean?
It'd be like James Bond, Bond smokescreen. Imagine that.
But you know what I mean? If it went off by mistake, then there's a problem.
Yeah.
Would it be quick enough? Would it happen quick enough to, I don't know. I just think there's a lot going on in them. Crash situations, and to make it more confusing sometimes will be quite easy. Anything that gives the following riders the ability to know and give them an edge up quicker would be an advantage.
Mm.
You've just said it there, I think, with that the key to it would be in anything speed, because all the impacts that have taken the lives, especially that one in Red, what you came out the corner and hit him straight away, they're into flare on the planet, and there was a light on the dash that is going to come quick enough for that.
No, you need reaction time after that. You know, you need not only your rider, your following rider to see it, but he's got to react.
If a rider crashes in front of you, there's not a yellow flag or a yellow light or anything that there's nothing, is there, that can change that avoidance of that.
Time collision is your thing. It's time.
And JT, just before we move on from this topic, I suppose finally, the industry needs to be careful, and you know, it's treading on thin ice in some ways, but it needs to be careful it doesn't shoot itself in both feet as well, doesn't it? Because at the end of the day, without sounding callous here, motorcycle racing is extremely dangerous, always has been, and always will be.
Yeah, but you go back to what Witt said, you know, if you're 18 years old and you can pass that you are compos mentis enough that you've got all your faculties in line, and when you say I want to get a helmet on and I want to go out racing, and we can't see anything obvious that we need to protect you from as an adult, crack on with whatever you want to do. Yeah. Like Witt said.
Well, agreeing, Tyler.
Well, boys, just before we sign off,
that's obviously physical, because obviously we have medicals, don't we? We have a medical to check everything, and we have a physical. Yeah. So if you pass a medical and a physical, and you still want to do it as an adult, then
your choice in life.
You know, I mean, there's, you know, you could fall off a horse, you could fall, you know,
correct.
You could, whatever it is, you know, you've got to do what you want to do.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, just before we sign off, just a few quick other points that we need to watch out for this weekend. We've obviously got manufacturers' fight is still going on, teams championship. I'm keen to see who's going to get fourth. Rinaldi versus Locatelli's been a great battle all year long. Top independent, will it be Gerloff? Will it be Bassani? And then Witt, Chaz Davis. It's going to be an emotional weekend for Chaz. How nice would it be if he could just get that 100th podium? He's been on 99 ever since he was on the podium back in Estoril.
Yeah, I think that he's got a chance. We know that on his day, we know that Chaz is capable of running right at the pointed end. Really would love to see that. I have to say, I'd love to see the 100th podium. Universally liked and respected in the paddock. He's the nicest fella you're ever going to meet. There's other nice guys in the paddock. We know that. We get on with 99% of them, don't we? But he's particularly intelligent and articulate. And it doesn't, I mean, not that I would be worried about anybody. You make your own way in life. But you look at some riders, you think, when you retire, what have you got? But actually, in Chaz's case, he's intelligent, he's hardworking, and he's level-headed like you cannot believe. And he will do something. And whatever he does, he'll do all right.
Yeah.
Hear, hear. And, it, you know, like you say, and if it is raining on a brand new track in Indonesia on a Ducati, you know, there's not much you ain't got to have a good do.
Yeah.
A good do. That's
a Yorkshire thing. I don't know what it is here at Eurosport. You've either got to be called James or come from Yorkshire to get a job here, apart from
or both
in your case. Yeah, both of you. Oh, by the way, Tom Booth Amos, that was just confirmed last week as well. He's got a World Supersport ride with the Pradina team. That's really good. And Ben Curry's got a Supersport ride for next year as well with the Pichetti back team. That's good news. Both nice guys, both deserving of those rides.
Yeah, I think in the case of Tom Booth Amos, quick rider, lots of talent. I think he... We have yet to see if he can make the jump. All I would say, it's a big step from a bike with, 47 horsepower that weighs under and sort of, best part, 140 kilos on its own to a bike that isn't much heavier with probably three times the power at least. So it's a big step. He's an intelligent lad and he's prepared to have a go. So the best to him. Ben Curry, it's his big chance. He's always wanted. He went into British Supersport as a stepping stone, only intended to be there for a year when he arrived from Australia. He got rather bogged down, which some people do in BSB, and it didn't. That original plan didn't work for him, and I wish him all the best. It's a big ask. All I would say is, Supersport changes next year, and we don't know what effect the changes are going to have. We don't know whether, you know, a 959cc BMW with a weight penalty is going to be miles better than anything else on track or miles worse. We don't know. So it might just have lucked out and might get lucky. And who knows? But all the best to him. It'd be good to see him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I second all that. There ain't much that Tom Booth Amos doesn't think he can't do. I know he's over the swagger. and that's what you need in life. You know what I mean? It's going to go from a 400.
Statement of the day for me, that. let me just get me around that again. There isn't much. Say again.
I don't know. I don't know if I can say it again myself.
God, that's absolutely perfect. I mean, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. But Don't you think you need a little bit of that sometimes?
You do.
Yeah.
That was my next sentence. And if you're moving from a lower horsepower bike up to the super sport guys against all of those really, really fast, you know, I think Agata's signed again for the next year. So you're going to have the world champion there, which is going to be not easy. You know, you've got a certain Bayliss back on the grid.
Yes. Yes, true. Brilliant.
Not the one we've formerly known, but Ollie on the night. And I think that's a great call, by the way, from Troy. You know, get him in there, learning the tracks. It's not a super sport bike anymore. So you're not learning the wrong things if you do want to go to superbike anymore. It's a 1,000cc Ducati twin.
Yeah.
So you're riding the tracks, learning the tracks on something similar to what you want to be getting on the next one. That's what this new super sport championship is going to be like.
I can't wait to see that. One of the reasons I can't wait to see Ollie in the paddock is because I want to see Troy in the paddock. Man, I've never ever, I mean, you know him a lot better than me, but in my little bit of knowledge of him, I've never known a more determined stickler in my whole life. I went to see him, he was 50-odd year old, he's making a bit of a comeback in Aussie Superbike, on a Ducati, obviously. This is going back about 3 years when we last went out there commentating. And I went to see him in pit lane, and session had just finished, and he's qualified third or whatever. And I thought he'd be having a right old laugh and really enjoying it. And I said, "Hey, what are you doing, you silly old sod?" He goes, "Hey, mate, I'm serious." And he was dead. He looked at me like he had lasers for eyes. And I thought, "Oh my God,
awful.
The man's serious."
Awful.
Yeah.
Awful. Yeah. Try racing against the bugger.
Yeah.
I tell you what, he's just thinking about it. He's the top of my list to be on a really long road trip and you've run out of sweets.
Run out of Werther's Originals, you know, JT. Is that what you're saying?
And he's getting a bit hungry, you know?
He'd be looking at you and you know what he'd be thinking.
Yeah, it was your responsibility to get the sweets, you know? Sweaty palm situation that would be. That's great though, isn't it? I mean, you know, with Remy Gardner, with obviously Bayliss, with Mackenzie's, it's like the dad and lad thing is really
good
kicking off, isn't it? It's racing ain't a sport, it's a life.
If it's not for you, you're in the wrong job.
Absolutely. And there's a reason why the sons are doing it, because they've grown up in a paddock as well.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, I always remember Harger's three little lads. I don't know what they're doing now, but they must be on a
motorbike somewhere. Well, they've raced a little bit.
Have they? They must be.
They've raced the Italian championship, one of them. Yeah, I don't know just how far they've got or how far they intend getting, but they were in the paddock on little scooters and bicycles running into your ankles from being about 2 years old, weren't they? Little pets.
I tell you, you know, especially MotoGP doing 21 rounds, honestly, it's a full-on way of life. I think you're literally 7 months away from home in total, you know?
It's a
huge, huge commitment. So if you're traveling around with your family and all the rest of it, it's all they know as well.
That wouldn't do for you, James. Who'd water your yucca plant when you're standing up?
Every Monday, James, that is. Every Monday.
We are, by the way, we are going to try and make this a video podcast in the future, so we'd be able to actually see that plant. It's a lovely plant there, James.
Cheers. I actually got that from a moving in present off my mum, right?
There's no wrong with that.
Walking out nursery, and you're actually saying it with your mum, if you have to get your parents to dress you and make decisions for you, right, you shouldn't be racing. I'm thinking, shit, I'm like that now. I might start racing next year when I grow up.
Now, this has just reminded me why I've loved working with you both so much this year. It has been a pleasure. By the way, just back to Ducati, I hear they're going to pour a load of money into that because Nicolo Buniga's on one as well, isn't he? So it might be bad news for Go 11 in superbikes, because I think a lot of that cash is going to go to Supersport next year.
Yeah, and do you know, on a bit of a sort of side thing, that because Ducati are putting a bit of effort into that new Supersport class, or the new regulation Supersport class, you have to think that they are not nuggets. And you have to think they've looked at the rules as published by the organisers, and they must have thought, do you know what? We can do this. We've got a bike for this. Our bike's going to be really competitive. Because if it wasn't, there's no way they'd be putting a huge load of effort behind it. And they are. And I think the Ducati could be could be the one to have.
Wait a minute, are you saying an Italian team with an Italian bike is stretching out the rules? Stretching out the rules as far as you can take them. I mean,
yeah,
I'll be a first, that surely.
And an Italian rider.
Yeah, you know they've got a bit of an idea what they can do, I think.
Right, before we sign off, just a quick reminder for everyone that we will be on air, and JT, for you in the London studio, this is going to be an interesting one. 3 a.m. on Saturday morning, and then 3:30 a.m. on Sunday morning. This is going to be a unsociable hours, but I can't think of a better reason to get up or stay up at that time of the day than Indonesia World Superbikes. What's going to happen then, guys? Final point before we sign off. Who is going to win? I would not want to put money on this, because with the number of twists we've already seen this year, anything could happen. JT, start with you on this one. Who's going to win the World Superbike Championship this year?
Can I tell you Friday afternoon?
Well, you can.
Literally.
Who would you actually say, if you had to put £10 on it now, and it's almost impossible, who would you go for?
It is a real tough one, because you've got the nationality thing. You've got how well Jonathan's ridden on that Kawasaki. It shouldn't be in the title hunt, really. So you've got that respect. But if anything did sway it, I've sat down with Toprak a couple of times. My God, what a lovely man. You read a little bit about his troublesome history first personally, and you read why he turned down a MotoGP ride, because he wants to win a superbike championship on a Yamaha, because his dad rode a Yamaha. If you just do a little bit of research on his background, you'd be like, oh my God, if that can all happen, I'd be raising a glass. And he's 30 points in the lead with the way he's ridden, without any mistakes. I don't think anybody'd argue with the first Turkish superbike champion ever. But I wouldn't argue if Jonathan pipped it from 30 points behind either, because if he pulls another 30 points this weekend, I'll doff my cap to both of them, either of them. Whoever does it, I'll be like, fair play. But someone on Sunday night, especially Toprak, is going to be massively disappointed if he doesn't, because he's not going to get a better chance than this.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Who I want to win is relevant. Who I think is going to win is Toprak. He's got a 30-point lead. He's not dropped the ball yet this year. It's a completely level playing field. However, just exactly like James just said, if somehow there's something happened and Jonathan can wrestle the trophy back out of Toprak's hands, well, you'd have to respect and take it after that as well. So the fact is, it's going to be a belter.
Make the best man win.
Correct.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. May the best man win. Well, guys, thanks very much to both of you. It has been a pleasure. And I know we'd like to take the mic, don't we? We have a lot of banter on and off air. We'll do one more podcast next week after the race in the commentary box. But JT, you'll be in the studio this weekend with James Hayden and Matt Roberts. Looking forward to the studio in the early hours of the morning? Get some pizzas in?
Not really. To be honest, I wish I was on commentary, because at 3 o'clock in the morning, I could have turned up in my pyjamas.
Oh, that's what we'll be doing. Yeah.
I've got to get dolled up in the studio.
The way you look and the way I look, the only one of you going to get in the flipping studio.
Bear in mind, he's only got one eye, so that's going to be taken with a pinch of salt.
Yeah. I've got feelings as well.
Sorry.
I was actually wondering who you're on about. I'm thinking, what?
yeah, you're right, vision-wise, aren't you, Jason?
Let's not.
I'm digging myself into a deeper hole here. Yeah.
Between three men, let's not discuss one eyes.
Anyway,
I was going to say, yeah, be careful. You'll have a writ.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the last thing we need.
I'll be speaking to my legal team.
Okay, well, I'll see.
To be honest, with the situation of the last race, though, and I think I actually would set the alarm anyway, so I'd be up anyway. So
for sure. Right,
we might as well add to the show.
Yeah, well, I'll see you in the commentary box. Thanks both for this. It's been a pleasure, and yeah, as you both said before, may the best man win. Well, there we go. Then there's not much else we can add to that. May the best man win. I will feel so sorry for Jonathan Rea or Toprak Razgatlioglu. Whoever doesn't come out on top, whoever wins very much deserves it. And you just think we're in for a hell of a weekend once again, don't you? As I said there, Witt and I will be back from the commentary box. I wonder what sort of mood everybody will be in by then. How much tension will we have seen? How many more twists will there have been in what has been an incredible season? This is the 34th season of World Superbikes. Definitely one of the very best, if not the best, since it all started back in 1988. Next Monday, the 22nd of November, I'll be back with Wit. But in the meantime, make the most of this. It's the last motorcycle racing for a while. And what a weekend it could be. We'll see you this weekend, live in the early hours of Saturday morning, starting with Super Pole. Hold on to your hats.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.